Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the January 13th Saturday reading of the Arapaho County News. My name is Tim Elliott. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Aurora shelters open for city's homeless as winter winds, cold become dangerous, by Max Levy, Sentinel, Colorado staff writer. Arapaho County says property tax bills coming late while deadlines remain the same, by Max Levy, Sentinel, Colorado staff writer. Colorado's Healthy Meals for All program sees a dramatic increase in daily meals served, by Lisa Glassman, special to Colorado Community Media. Chad Clifford selected for House District 37 after Ruby Dixon's resignation, by Taylor Shaw. Police arrest man suspected of Littleton arson, by Nina Joss. New affordable housing complex for seniors in Littleton generates high demand, Nina Joss. And various stories and articles. Aurora shelters open for city's homeless as winter winds, cold become dangerous. It's absolutely deadly. Snow, ice, and fierce winter winds will bring life-threatening cold to Aurora this weekend, and the city is urging its hundreds of homeless residents to seek shelter. The National Weather Service forecasts temperatures plunging from a daytime high of about 33 degrees on Friday to an overnight low of 10 degrees below zero, with snow likely and wind gusts up to 30 miles per hour expected. Friday night's freezing winds will be cold enough to inflict frostbite on the face of an exposed person within 10 minutes, according to the agency's wind chill charts. When we have persistent cold weather with no breaks and freezing temperatures and these intense winds and wind chill factors, it's absolutely deadly, said Kathy Alderman of the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless. Adults with non-aggressive vaccinated pets or no pets can escape the cold at the Aurora Day Resource Center, located near the University of Colorado School of Medicine in North Aurora at 13387 East 19th Place. The center opened for sheltering January 7th and will remain open 24 hours a day through January 17th. Anna Miller, Public Relations Director for Mile High Behavioral Health Care, which operates the Aurora Day Resource Center and Comatose Crisis Center, said families seeking shelter in Aurora should contact the Comatose Crisis Center's emergency line at 303-340-9160. At the same time, City Spokesman Ryan Luby said the Aurora's Cold Weather Outreach Team, staffed jointly by city employees, Mile High Behavioral Health Care, and Aurora Mental Health and Recovery, is visiting known homeless encampments, offering rides to the Aurora Day Resource Center as well as winter weather gear. The team plans to operate through January 14th. Luby said members of the public who observe individuals who appear to be unable to take care of themselves in the cold should call 911. However, he said Aurorians do not need to call 911 solely to report the locations of encampments, since the outreach team is very aware of their placement throughout the city. It is critically important for all of us to check on our family and neighbors and make sure they have a safe place to be, Luby said Friday. We are grateful for ACOT's diligence and expertise in routinely working with people experiencing homelessness and in conducting targeted outreach to get them into a warm, safe place. Temps will barely climb above zero on Saturday, dropping to around 7 degrees below zero overnight, with frigid breezes continuing to heighten the risk of frostbite. Winds will continue to blow Sunday, and the overnight sub-zero cold is expected to last through Monday. Arapaho County says property tax bills coming late while deadlines remain the same. The county says property owners will still have to pay by the previous deadlines to avoid owing interest. Arapaho County says the property tax relief law passed by Colorado's General Assembly after voters rejected Proposition HH means property owners will be getting their tax bills by mid-February rather than the end of January. Regardless, the county says property owners will still have to pay by the previous deadlines to avoid owing interest. The Colorado legislature kept the existing payment deadline to ensure that essential services provided by our special districts, including fire departments, school districts, health districts, hospitals, and other public entities, continue to receive the necessary funding without interruption, Arapahoe County Treasurer Michael Westerberg said in a news release. November's property tax relief law lowered the taxable value of residential properties, meaning homeowners will pay less in property taxes. The change also delayed Arapahoe County's certification of its tax rolls, which will cause tax bills to be mailed late. For bills less than $25, the full amount of the taxes must be paid by April 30th. For larger bills, taxpayers can either make one full payment by April 30th or two half payments, with the first half due February 29th and second half due June 15th. Questions for the County Treasurer's Office can be submitted to at www.arapahoegov.com or by emailing treasurer@arapahoegov.com or calling 303-795-4550. Science scores low tuition, full education funding highlighted in Polis' annual speech. This has been a long time coming, Polis said, and we are thrilled to fulfill our commitment to voters and enter a new era of full education funding in Colorado. By Jason Gonzalez of Chalk Beat, Colorado. In his annual State of the State speech Thursday, Governor Jared Polis thanked lawmakers for agreeing to end a longstanding Colorado practice of withholding money from K-12 schools to balance the state budget. His words were met with a standing ovation. "This has been a long time coming," Polis said, "and we are thrilled to fulfill our commitment to voters and enter a new era of full education funding in Colorado." Since 2009, the state has withheld more than $10 billion from Colorado schools through a mechanism known as the Budget Stabilization Factor. Last year, lawmakers passed a provision within the state's education funding bill to eliminate the withholding. While the provision isn't binding, Polis, along with other Democrat and Republican leaders, have said they wanted to keep that promise. Polis said in his speech that this year's promise to fund schools without taking away money would mean better teacher pay, more learning opportunities for students, increased training for teachers, and better resources in classrooms. State lawmakers on the powerful Joint Budget Committee, which helps craft the state budget, echoed Polis. State Senator Barbara Kirkmeyer, a Weld County Republican, said she and fellow JBC members plan to make sure that education is funded responsibly and sustainably. "We're not going to go back to where we were balancing our budget on the backs of students," Kirkmeyer said in an interview. "It's not going to happen, not in my time." What else did Polis say about education in his speech? Here are some highlights. What Polis means by greater efficiency in higher education. What Polis said: "We are working with higher education institutions to keep tuition low through innovation and greater efficiency." What that means: higher education budgets are again a topic of concern this year among lawmakers after the governor's November budget proposal, especially because Colorado students pay more to go to an in-state public university than the national average. Polis' budget set aside $93.7 million more for college and university budgets and financial aid. Another $3 million would be used to support the college attendance of youth who have experienced homelessness. Joint Budget Committee members have said they want to give more state money to colleges and universities on top of what Polis has proposed, especially because school leaders have said they'll have difficulty keeping tuition rates at the mandated 2% increase for in-state students and 6% increase for out-of-state students next year. While Polis' priorities help shape the budget, ultimately the General Assembly adopts a budget in March or April that is actually written by the six legislatures on the Joint Budget Committee. During a news conference after his State of the State address, Polis said greater efficiency would include analyzing administrative costs at schools and ensuring state money goes toward teaching students. Kirkmeyer said she's disappointed in the amount of money Pohl has earmarked. The reality is, if we don't cover basic core costs at our institutions of higher education, Kirkmeyer said, then the tuition has to go up. And I'm with him on let's keep the tuition down. But let's not, as one of our university presidents said, bleed out higher education, because that's what he is doing. Colorado Senate President Stephen Fenberg, a Boulder Democrat, said Democrats have been supportive of higher education and ensuring they can be strong to train the workforce. But we also do agree that we need to take a hard look, he said. There are limited resources, and so yes, we do need to partner with our institutions and make sure that they are providing services and degrees in a manner that's efficient and that's worth the investment. Science instruction gets a boost. What Polis said. Last year, we also passed bipartisan legislation to help more students and educators access the resources they need to improve math achievement. Now we need to expand out of school opportunities to boost science achievement, too. What that means. The state has focused on boosting resources to improve reading and math instruction in recent years. Not all students statewide take the test, but 2023 statewide science results show about a third of students in 5th and 8th grade meet or exceed its standards. About a quarter of all students in 11th grade met or exceeded standards in the test. Last year, Colorado set aside $28 million to increase math resources statewide, including for after-school programs and tutoring. This year, the governor updated his budget proposal in January to include $8 million to support science education. About $3 million will go to schools to improve curriculum and training for educators. Another $5 million would fund out-of-school academic support for Colorado students. Colorado House Speaker Julie McCluskey, a Dillon Democrat, said as someone who graduated college with a chemistry degree, she's very supportive of the focus. We've got to make sure we're nurturing young minds in the sciences to be sure they're ready for those careers, she said. Polis promises to expand workforce training. What Polis said. Right now, there are about 2 job openings for every unemployed Coloradan. We want every person in Colorado to be able to build a good life and a good career on their own terms, and we are creating many different ways to do that. What that means. Polis and lawmakers made an investment last year in expanding free training programs across the state in certain fields such as healthcare, firefighting, law enforcement, and education. The goal from the state is to train more Coloradans for in-demand jobs. Some of those industries, however, don't pay as high, and the state's free training program is meant to help subsidize that education so students aren't saddled with debt by choosing those careers. Polis said during his speech that the program has already served over 3,500 students. Polis has his eyes on expanding other opportunities too, such as apprenticeships that help students learn on the job. We want to go even further, increasing the number of state government apprenticeships by 50% and supporting the creation of 100 new apprenticeship opportunities in the private sector, both by June 30th of this year, he said. Polis' November budget proposal included $2 million in grant funding and $30 million in tax credits to expand apprenticeship programs. And he wants $2 million more in Opportunity Now grants, as well as $30 million in tax credits to support the state program. The program helps develop public-private partnerships focused on workforce development. Aurora Police Chief Acevedo talks crime rate, legacy of Elijah McClain in 2023 appraisal. By Max Levy, Sentinel, Colorado staff writer. Summing up the past year of policing in Aurora, Interim Police Chief Art Acevedo said Thursday that the city's cops have embraced a culture of accountability. We want to hold ourselves accountable, Acevedo said. Responsible organizations look for opportunities for how can we do things differently, how can we do things better, and that's what we are. We are a learning organization. Accountability took many forms in 2023. Looking outward, Acevedo boasted that the city's elected leaders and cops turned Aurora into an island of accountability for criminals through proactive enforcement backed up with the threat of mandatory jail sentences for crimes such as vehicle and retail theft. Aurora's motor vehicle theft rate fell by about 23.5% between 2022 and 2023, part of a 11.6% reduction in property crime overall, while violent crime declined by about 14.5% according to the department. Rates of property crime and violent crime both statewide and in other large cities such as Denver were also trailing 2022 rates approaching the end of last year, according to the state and federal analysis report. Turning inward, accountability looked like the police department striving to meet the expectations of the reform agreement that was crafted to crack down on excessively violent, racist policing by Aurora officers. The department made strides, including by rewriting policies on physical force and constitutional rights, retraining officers on those policies, and changing how uses of force are reviewed after the fact. Other times, the department fell short, struggling most of the year to roll out a system that would allow police to track use of force and breezing past a deadline for anti-bias training. For the family of Elijah McClain, whose death gave rise to the city's reform agreement, accountability meant watching three Aurora police officers and two firefighters go on trial for a criminally negligent homicide and assault. The prosecution was a mixed bag, resulting in convictions for the two firefighters and Officer Randy Rodema. Officers Jason Rosenblatt and Nathan Woodyard were acquitted. Woodyard was reinstated as a police officer in November. Acevedo said Woodyard remains on personal leave and would not be returned to a public-facing role if he decides to continue working for the department. Reflecting on the trials that followed the four-year anniversary of McClain's death, Acevedo said he believed officers would not have escalated the situation involving McClain if it occurred today. I believe that lives will be saved because of the changes that his death brought to our department in terms of the way we do business, Acevedo said, specifically mentioning changes to how and when officers are taught to use physical force. We failed Elijah McClain as a department. We failed Mrs. McClain as a department. We failed our community as a department. But we also failed the officers who encountered him that night. We needed to do better. And, thank God, as a result of that tragedy, our men and women are doing phenomenal work. Acevedo led police agencies in Austin, Houston, and Miami before he was chosen to serve as the Aurora Police Department's interim chief at the end of 2022. The move capped off a year of tumult, which saw the city of Aurora fire its police chief, Vanessa Williams, and launch a national search for her replacement, only to come up empty-handed. Acevedo stated that ended 2023 as the city's interim police chief. He declined to say Thursday whether he will seek permanent appointment. Despite the lack of turnover at the top of the department, Aurora Police grappled with the public over other controversies in 2023, including the rehiring of Matt Green, who threatened McClain with a police dog while McClain was restrained on the ground, and the prosecutions of now former officers Douglas Haroon and Eduardo Landeros. The first test of Acevedo's leadership came in June 2023 when a black teenager, Jordell Richardson, was shot by an Aurora police officer who said Richardson fled from the scene of an armed robbery and then reached for a pellet gun resembling a firearm after he was tackled to the ground. Acevedo initially described the pellet gun as a firearm and didn't correct the misrepresentation for several days, leading activists to accuse him of lying to deflect criticism from the officers involved. Acevedo insists he wasn't told about the discrepancy until the day before he acknowledged it publicly. The officer who fired the fatal shot was later cleared by internal investigators and the Office of District Attorney John Kellner for his decision to use lethal force. On Thursday, Acevedo again referred to the incident as a tragedy, but said the department will base its actions in response to officer-involved killings on the facts, the evidence, and the law, and not on which way the wind is blowing. We have to call balls and strikes. Leaders don't come to work to keep their jobs. They come to work to do their jobs, a CVEDO said. And that is a two-way street. I don't care what the union rep thinks. Let's face it. If you listen to the union rep, no officer has ever done anything wrong. A CVEDO said he selected the department's current senior leadership based on the commitment to police work and willingness to cooperate in reforms. He added that McLean's death reflected a failure of leadership in the department and that some of the controversy surrounding Wilson's tenure as chief was due to people that were undermining her. While the department continues to struggle with staffing, he said he takes pride in a boom in officers progressing through academy training, 30 people as of December, and insisted the department is moving in the right direction. Describing Aurora's consent decree reform agreement as an opportunity for the department to embrace learning and professional development, Acevedo voiced optimism about the department being able to exit the first phase of the agreement in the near future. The second phase of the agreement will focus on monitoring the department's ongoing compliance with the reforms enacted during the first phase. Acevedo said an online portal that will allow the public to access aggregate data about the department's enforcement activities would also become active in a matter of weeks, reflecting the consent decree's emphasis on transparency. Before leaving Thursday's news conference, Acevedo expressed frustration over journalist scrutiny of the department, saying that no department in Colorado has been scrutinized and maligned over and over again. He also took a parting shot at the department's union representatives. "Please take time to thank the men and women that wear this badge," Acevedo said. "They deserve support, and when they screw up as an individual, we're going to hold them accountable. And I don't care what the union thinks. We're not here to work for the union. We're not here to work for anybody but the public and our men and women." Colorado's Health Meals for All program sees dramatic increase in daily meals served. On any given day, as many as 400 students pass through Andrea Cicinero's lunch line at West Woods Elementary in Arvada. Depending on the meal, that number is roughly 100 to 200 more than she's used to serving in prior years. The increased demand is due to the voter-approved Healthy School Meals for All initiative run by the Colorado Department of Education. The program allows all students access to free school meals regardless of family income. When the bill passed, many speculated more students would take advantage of the program because it would reduce the stigma associated with qualifying for free or reduced lunch and eliminate financial constraints for others. Yet no one knew for sure. After 5 months, the verdict is in. Ellie Agor, Director of Communications for Hunger Free Colorado, the organization that led the campaign to pass the HSMA program, confirmed schools are seeing an average increase of 30 to 40% in lunch and breakfast participation. The increase is even higher among students who previously didn't participate in free or reduced price lunch, either due to income or stigma, Agor said. Cisnerios, kitchen manager and 23-year-old Jefferson County School District veteran, said she sees the impact on low-income families daily. "One mom of three kids in my school missed qualifying for free lunch by $1 last year," Cisnerio said. "She used to worry constantly about how to feed her kids lunch. It's been a huge burden lifted from her shoulders." Cisnerio also sees how free meals have changed students' attitudes toward going through the lunch line. "I've been told it's now cool to get your food for free. There's no stigma. Everyone just gets to eat." Cisneros said she used to risk getting reprimanded for giving kids who had nothing to eat without charging them, but she couldn't stand letting any child in her school go hungry. It makes her happy to know that it's no longer an issue. According to Agar, parents can save more than $1,250 per student each year, alleviating financial stress while food and living costs rise. Feeding more students doesn't come without challenges, however. Kitchens remained understaffed, and Cisneros says by the time some kids get through the line, they've sold out of meals or the student has little time to eat before lunch is over. Agor acknowledged the issue and noted that districts should apply for grants for more local purchasing, scratch cooking, training, and wage boost for frontline staff next year. She's hoping the wage increases will help address some of these issues. Parents have also communicated that they'd like more fresh and culturally relevant options in the coming years. While those plans are in the works, Agar said families can partner with school districts through student and parent advisory committees to help provide students with more enticing food. Phase 2 implementation. The next phase of HSMA implementation, which begins in the 24-25 school year, allows schools to apply for local purchasing grants for high-quality, locally sourced food. When the HSMA program is fully implemented, it will have one of the most robust farm-to-school programs in the nation, Agar said. Farmers and producers are already strategizing how to use the newly available resources to strengthen local food systems and support small farmers. The next phase also involves gaining feedback from student and parent advisory committees and giving decision-making power to these groups to ensure meals remain healthy and appealing. Colorado is the first state in the nation to establish these committees, providing a unique opportunity to set a new transformational standard for the country, Agar said. Anyone wanting to get involved can contact their local nutrition staff or the Hunger Free Colorado team to share their experiences. Eliminating poor quality food. Cisneros recently won Education Support Professional of the Year by the Colorado Education Association for her efforts to boycott junk food from her school and begin a composting program that teaches kids about recycling and reducing food waste. She was part of a bargaining effort on behalf of the Jefferson Education Support Professional Association that successfully won a pilot program to begin working with local farmers to provide fresh food for 3 Jefferson County schools. Cisneros is on a mission to teach her students about the impacts of junk food and the importance of eating the colors of the rainbow. She also wants her students to know where their food comes from and is constantly looking for creative ways to help them learn about food while standing in line. Cisneros is up for National Education Association Support Professional of the Year. The winner will be announced in March. Chad Clifford selected for House District 37 seat after Ruby Dixon's resignation. Just days before the 2024 legislative session at Colorado's Capitol is set to begin, a Democratic committee has selected a replacement for Ruby Dixon, the representative who suddenly resigned several weeks ago, citing a toxic political environment. Chad Clifford, a lobbyist who serves as a police officer for several agencies through the Colorado Rangers, will step in for Dixon to represent House District 37, which includes parts of Greenwood Village, Centennial, and unincorporated Arapahoe County. Clifford also serves as a government operations lead for the American Red Cross. He comes into a legislature that begins session on January 10th after months of tension among Democrats. Dixon, a Democrat whose term was slated to end in January 2025, resigned in December, citing the sensationalistic and vitriolic nature of the current political environment and the effects on her family. And Rep. Sayed Sabrina, a former public defender from Brighton, also resigned, complaining about vitriol, long hours, and low pay at the legislature. Clifford acknowledged the political climate looks difficult. Even in such a vitriolic time in the Capitol, I'm excited to go and see what kind of difference I could make, Clifford said during a candidate forum this week. He believes he can make a difference regarding the vitriolic nature that we have in the Capitol, saying he has strong negotiation skills and can bring people together. It's just really crazy that the Democrats are fighting the Democrats in a building where it's supposed to be a place of debate, he said. He said he suspects there may soon be a vote of no confidence for Speaker of the House Julie McCluskey, as well as a potential vote to censure State Representative Elizabeth Epps. As reported by Colorado Politics on November 23rd, Epps, a Denver Democrat, joined pro-Palestinian protesters in the House gallery and later shouted down to the House floor. At one point, she called other legislators fascists, according to the article. In December, McCluskey made the decision to remove Epps and Representative Bob Marshall, Democrat Highlands Ranch, from the House Judiciary Committee, which the Colorado Sun said is one of the most influential panels in the legislature. Three candidates, including Clifford, Ashish Viada, and Kevin Beal, ran to fill Dixon's vacant seat. According to the Colorado Democratic Party, vacancies are run by the political party of the resigning member. The members of the district's vacancy committee are the voting members. In the vacancy committee's initial vote on January 3rd, Videa got 20 votes, Clifford got 19 votes, and Beal got 2 votes. Per the election rules, a candidate needed 50% plus one of the votes to win, so a revote was held between just Videa and Clifford. On the revote, Clifford won with 22 votes while Videa got 19. After winning, Clifford thanked the committee and said he was about to cry. When asked about being prepared for this role, Clifford said he would have spent every day in the legislative session anyway as a lobbyist. I already have a ton of relationships inside the Capitol. I've also been at work with other legislatures and some leadership on bills that I plan to introduce this session going right in, he said. I plan to introduce 3 different pieces of legislation that I've already been at work on, he said. Clifford said the biggest issue facing House District 37 is housing. We currently have a pretty significant crisis with housing inventory that has trickled down to cause issues all across the board, he said. The number one thing that we must deal with first is inventory. He said he wants to incentivize builders to come to the community and reduce the red tape they may face. I just couldn't be more proud to be going to represent our district, he said. It wasn't something I had in my bingo card for 2024, and I couldn't be more pleased or excited to go and make a real difference. Clifford said he expects to campaign to keep the House District 37 seat in the November election. Colorado Catholic preschools make their case at trial challenging non-discrimination rules. By Ann Schmick, Chalkbeak, Colorado. Enrolling preschoolers from LGBTQ families would conflict with the religious beliefs and obligations of Catholic preschools, attorneys for 2 Denver-area Catholic parishes said on January 2nd as the trial began in a lawsuit of challenging the non-discrimination rules in Colorado's universal preschool program. 2 Catholic parishes that run preschools, St. Mary's in Littleton and St. Bernadette's in Lakewood, said the Archdiocese of Denver sued the state in federal district court in August. They argued that the non-discrimination clause in an agreement required by the state for a participation in the preschool program conflicts with their mission to provide a Catholic education. Senior U.S. District Judge John L. Kane, who is presiding over the trial, recently issued an order dismissing the Archdiocese as a plaintiff. Attorneys for the state said Catholic preschools under the Archdiocese are being treated the same as other preschools in the program, and that the non-discrimination agreement in question is similar to the one some Catholic schools have signed in the past for other kinds of publicly funded programs. The lawsuit could have big implications for the new $322 million preschool program, which launched in August and enrolls more than 60% of the state's 4-year-olds this year. A win for the Catholic preschools could bring more faith-based schools into the preschool program, but it could limit the state's ability to set non-discrimination policies for an education program that it pays for. A win for the state could deter some faith-based preschools from participating, but it means families with LGBTQ parents or children couldn't be shut out of preschools because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. The trial is expected to last several days with the judge making the decision. 4 witnesses testified for the Catholic preschools in early January, including the mother who said her family would have saved several thousand dollars if the Catholic preschool her 4-year-old attends had been able to participate in universal preschool this year. Colorado's universal preschool program offers 10 to 30 hours of tuition-free preschool a week to 4-year-olds. Families can pick preschool classrooms in public schools, private child care centers, faith-based programs, or state-licensed homes. The two parish preschools that sued declined to join the program after the Archdiocese instructed them not to sign the statement's non-discrimination agreement, which prohibits discrimination based on religion, sexual orientation, and gender identity, among other factors. The lawsuit asserts that the non-discrimination clause could prevent them from prioritizing children from Catholic families for enrollment or force them to admit a child who identifies as a gender at odds with their biological sex, or a child whose parents identify as gay or lesbian or are part of a same-sex couple. The suit also argues that the state's non-discrimination rules would prohibits preschools from hiring employees who agree with the Catholic Church's mission and teachings, including that marriage is limited to one man and one woman for life. The lawsuit is one of two that religious preschools have filed over the state program. The other one, filed by a Christian preschool in Chaffee County that's participating in the Universal Preschool Program this year, also argues that the non-discrimination provision could impede hiring, but didn't focus on enrollment questions. A federal judge issued a preliminary injunction in October in that case, barring the state from punishing or withholding funds from the Chaffee County preschool, even though some of its policies appear to violate the non-discrimination agreement. A third lawsuit was filed by several school districts last summer and deals with services and funding for preschoolers with disabilities as well as other high-needs students. Nick Reeves, a lawyer for the Catholic preschool, said that in rare circumstances, schools overseen by the Archdiocese of Denver have turned away families on the grounds that their beliefs or practices conflict with what the school teaches. He said there have been no complaints from any LGBTQ families about any of the 36 preschools that operate under the Archdiocese. During her testimony on January 2nd, Avery Coates, principal of the pre-K-8 school operated by St. Bernadette's, described turning away a prospective fifth grade student because the parents were a same-sex couple and school officials worried Catholic teachings would cause confusion and conflict in the family. Of the more than 1,900 preschools that joined Colorado's Universal Program this year, 40 are faith-based. Together, they serve about 900 children. State rules allow faith-based preschools to give children in their congregations priority for enrollment. But beyond that, they don't allow enrollment decisions based on a family's religion or beliefs. While some families choose religious preschools to match their faith, others choose them because the schools are close to their homes or jobs, or because they offer full daycare or flexible schedules. Lawyers for the Catholic preschools asked a state witness to clarify what kind of enrollment restrictions or conditions preschools in the Universal Program are allowed to have. For example, Reeves asked, could a Jewish preschool, as a condition of enrollment, ask parents to sign a statement of faith saying they won't eat pork and will keep kosher? The witness, Michael Cook, who helped roll out the Universal Preschool Program, said that the question hadn't come up before, but that the state wouldn't object to an enrollment condition based on the preschool's particular program. Where we would object is if there was something in a statement that a family needed to sign or acknowledge that is contrary to anything that's in statute or in policy or rule, Cook said. Police arrest man suspected of Littleton arson. The Denver Police Department has arrested the man suspected of arson in a November 17th fire in downtown Littleton. The Littleton Police Department obtained an arrest warrant related to the fire for James Daigle, 39, on December 11th. Since then, the department has been seeking the public's help in locating him. On January 11th, 1 month after Daigle's arrest warrant was issued, Denver police arrested Daigle in relation to an alleged burglary near the 1700 block of Stout Street, a department spokesperson said. When officers arrested Daigle, they learned he had an outstanding warrant related to the fire. Daigle is currently in custody in the Denver County Jail, Littleton police spokesperson Shira Pullman said. He is being held for investigation of the Denver burglary, the Denver police spokesperson said. Daigle faces felony charges including second-degree arson and criminal mischief related to the Littleton fire, according to court documents. He also faces a trespassing charge. The fire, which took place around midnight on November 17th, caused more than $3 million in damages to the building under construction at 5664 South Prince Street and a neighboring residential and commercial building. Nobody was injured or killed in the fire, officials said. New affordable housing complex for seniors in Littleton generates high demand. Overlook at Powers Park opens, marking a milestone in addressing local housing crisis. The lobby of an apartment building overflowed with people as Littleton leaders and neighbors gathered to celebrate the opening of a new affordable housing complex. The apartment building, which aims to help alleviate the high costs of housing, has a wait list almost three times higher than the number of units available. The creation of Overlook at Powers Park marks a monumental moment for South Metro Housing Options, the city's public housing authority. It is its first new construction development in 30 years. Developing affordable housing is no easy task, and this development was no different, Executive Director Corey Wright said at the grand opening on January 10th. We faced plenty of challenges, but we're just super excited that we've reached the finish line. The new complex includes 51 one-bedroom units for people aged 62 and over. Each unit is 510 square feet large and includes laundry and stainless steel appliances. There are several community gathering spaces within the building and a patio outside. Seven units were built for people with mobility challenges. The development is part of what South Metro Housing Options calls public housing repositioning, through which the authority is selling and redeveloping scattered public housing units across the city. On the property where Overlook at Powers Park now stands, there used to be 12 public housing units. These six buildings were demolished, and we were able to create this building and increase our number of units from 12 to 51, Wright said. We think this was a great start. South Metro Housing Options developed the apartment complex through a program called Low Income Housing Tax Credit. This program, created by the Tax Reform Act of 1986, gives agencies money to issue tax credits for the acquisition, rehabilitation, or new construction of rental housing for lower-income families. Households that make 30% to 60% of the area median income can qualify to live at Overlook at Powers Park, said Jennifer Robinson Thibault, Director of Operations at South Metro Housing Options. This means rent will range from $698 to $1,396 per unit, depending on each household's income, Robinson Thibault said. The property also accepts housing choice vouchers, formerly known as Section 8, which are federal rental subsidies. South Metro Housing Options partnered with Metro West Housing Solutions, Lakewood's housing authority, to apply for the tax credits to develop the property. The entire country is suffering from a severe affordable housing shortage, said Tammy Fisher, executive director at Metro West Housing Solutions. If we can help each other in whatever way we can, whether it's in your jurisdiction or you make all the money or your people get housed, it doesn't matter. There's so many people that need to be housed. We need to reach out and keep helping each other. Arapahoe County, Littleton Centennial, and the Colorado Division of Housing, among others, financially contributed to the project, which cost about $22 million total, according to South Metro Housing Options. Littleton Mayor Kyle Schlotchler said the new complex will be a great asset to the entire Littleton community. This is going to go a long way to addressing the housing issue, he said. It's a small step, but housing is really important to City Council, city staff, and our whole community. It's great that we're all able to work together and make sure that we can address this issue that we're seeing across the whole metro area here. The wait list for Overlook at Powers Park already has approximately 140 people on it, and residents are expected to start moving in the next couple of weeks, Wright said. He expects the complex to be fully occupied by the end of February. How the river and trail at Reynolds Landing Park in Littleton will change in coming years, by Nina Joss. A natural park along the South Platte River in Littleton will transfer over the next couple of years. The first stage of a project at Reynolds Landing Park will begin in September, adding ecological and recreational improvements to the area. Kelsey Stansfield, manager of grounds, open space, and natural resources for Littleton, said the project started as a need to rehabilitate the stretch of the river near the park, including making flood drainage and habitat improvements. But as the city and its partners were planning, the project evolved. Additional recreational opportunities really presented themselves, and the project just grew, Stansfield said. Now it's really a redesign of the whole space. In the first phase of the project, crews will work to reshape the river to function more naturally. Three large rocky areas in the river create hazardous conditions for people, barriers for river life, and have degraded habitats, according to project documents. The project will remove these barriers and add gradular drop structures or changes in elevation on the riverbed, creating features for tubers to ride down. Also, the drop structures help improve river flow and increase water depths, which improves fish habitat, Stansfield said. There will also be a walkway along the river's edge. Next to the riverbank, children, families, and other visitors will be able to step into shallow pools. The pools will create spaces for river ecosystems to thrive, project documents say. Stansfield said the pools will be Americans with Disability Act accessibility, making it possible for people with restricted mobility to experience the river like others. It's not something that you see a lot along the South Platte River, she said. There's been a lot of redesigns that really promote whitewater sports. We really wanted to do something different with this project and just attract a more diverse group of people. Vegetated terraces and banks will reintroduce native plant communities and habitats, documents say. There will also be improved seating and terraces and natural play areas for children. Through public engagement efforts, project managers learned about conflicts between walkers and bicyclists at the section of the Mary Carter Greenway Trail that passes through the park. The current location of the trail creates a barrier between the parkland and the river, Stansfield said, which can cause points of conflict when visitors cross the trail. To address this issue, the project will move a portion of the trail away from the river and elevate it, simultaneously creating a bridge for bicyclists to pass over and a gateway to the river for pedestrians. We really want to bring in pedestrians, and we want to bring in people that just want to relax without having to cross paths with bikers, Stansfield said. The first phase of the project is expected to be completed in 2026 and expected to cost about $15.5 million, which is a split among several project partners. The project is a product of a partnership between Littleton, the Mile High Flood Control District, South Suburban Parks and Recreation, Arapahoe County Open Space, the Colorado Water Conservation Board, the South Platte Working Group, and a local private donor who was not named, according to project documents. Great Outdoors Colorado, which invests proceeds it receives from the Colorado Lottery into environmental projects, recently awarded a $950,000 grant to support the first phase of the project. Matt Brady, a program officer for Great Outdoors Colorado, said the project stood out for its potential to support community vitality, as well as environmental benefits. It's just really exciting to see continued love and involvement of the South Platte River, he said. There's so much opportunity on the South Platte River that it's just cool to see communities continue to invest and evolve those parks and spaces to meet our growing population and demand on our local parks. Representative Marshall calls his inclusion in Colorado Open Meetings Law case hit job. By Haley, Lenny, and McKinney Hartford. State Representative Bob Marshall says he was singled out politically in a lawsuit in which a judge recently ruled that lawmakers' reliance on anonymous surveys to determine budget priorities is illegal. The judge found last week that the practice runs counter to the Colorado Open Meetings Law. But Marshall, a Democrat who represents Highland Ranch, said he should not have been named in the suit. He called his inclusion in it a political hit job because of his involvement in fighting for more transparency at the state capitol. The suit was brought by the nonprofit Public Trust Initiative and Highlands Ranch resident David Fornoff, and centered around what's called quadratic voting, which lawmakers use to determine which budget bill should go forward. Suzanne DeHerry, an attorney for West Group Law and Policy, who represented the plaintiffs, said the judge's decision was clear that the practice subverted the intentions of Colorado Open Meetings Law. The hit job, DeHerry said, was by legislatures, such as Marshall, against their own constituents. As a frequent litigator, including on open meetings issues, Representative Marshall should have known that this secret voting system violates the letter and spirit of state law, said DeHerry. DeHerry added that the Public Trust Institute had been fighting for records pertaining to the system for 2 years, including before Marshall was elected. We only filed the lawsuit when it became clear it was the only way to stop the practice, said DeHerry. The suit also named the Colorado House of Representatives, Colorado House Speaker Julie McCluskey, the Colorado Senate President Steve Feinberg, Senators Jeff Bridges and Chris Hansen, and Legislative Policy and Analyst Andrew Lindinger. According to court documents, the plaintiffs argued that the system called quadratic voting violated the intent and spirit of open meeting law and the Colorado Constitution's mandate for an open legislative process. They stress that the open meetings law are to be in favor of the public rather than exclusion. The defendants claimed quadratic voting fails to qualify as a meeting for the purposes of the open meetings law because it is wholly unrelated to the merits or substance of any matter being considered in courtroom documents. The defendants further argue that the voting system has been covered by the media and therefore cannot be considered a secret meeting. Marshall said he was not able to concede the suit as he was sued for documents under CORA, which he claims he did not have. Marshall told Colorado Community Media that he turned over everything he had to the plaintiff, but that they insisted that he had custody and control over the data entered into the quadratic voting system. He also said that he was opposed to the voting system and had even considered abolishing it in his other transparency efforts at the Capitol. He also said he didn't include the voting system in his effort because Democratic leadership said in July that they would stop using the voting system in future sessions, as reported by Colorado Public Radio. I don't think quadratic voting is appropriate, but I had a commitment that they weren't going to use it anymore, he said. Marshall also said that the anonymous votes were non-binding. Marshall added that he understands the view of the court. I am agnostic on the court's ruling, said Marshall, but I am glad to see these issues continue to come to light and are addressed. Colorado Community Media reached out to Bridges, whose Arapahoe County district includes Inglewood and most of Littleton, but did not hear back by deadline. Deal with Roofing Company brings end to Reinke Brothers bankruptcy case. By Nina Joss. A high-profile Halloween and costume store in Littleton, Reinke Brothers, has found a solution to financial issues that led to a short stretch in bankruptcy court. Reinke Brothers, which has operated for 55 years, filed a Chapter 11 reorganization bankruptcy at the end of October. Now, just a little over 2 months later, a judge has dismissed the case after the store and its largest creditor, a roofing company, reached an agreement. The conclusion of the bankruptcy case removes a cloud that caused some customers to fear the store would close, an outcome that co-owner Greg Reinke has consistently said will not happen. According to the bankruptcy filing, Reinke Brothers had about $326,000 in liabilities, with about 72% of that debt owed to the Littleton Roofing Company called Statewide Roofing Consultants, Inc. Based on legal filings, the two companies have been involved in civil litigation since 2016. The legal dispute concerns a roofing project conducted by Statewide Roofing on the Reinke Brothers building on Prince Street in downtown Littleton. Reinke Brothers has pursued claims of breach of contract, negligence, negligent misrepresentation, fraud by concealment, civil theft, and deceptive trade practices against the roofing company, according to court documents. The roofing company has pursued allegations of breach of contract and unjust enrichment against Reinke Brothers. In October, Reinke Brothers owed the roofing company about $234,000, according to the bankruptcy filings. The store also owed about $42,000 to the Arapahoe County Treasurer and about $38,000 to a company called TNT Construction Services, Inc. At the end of November, Reinke Brothers filed a motion for the dismissal of the bankruptcy case. The document says Reinke Brothers filed for relief under Chapter 11 solely because of the debt it owed to the roofing company and the roofing company's efforts to garnish and levy the assets of Reinke Brothers. But in the month after the bankruptcy filing, Reinke Brothers and the roofing company worked together to come to an agreement regarding the amounts owed, the document said. The agreement provides for a settlement of the Statewide Roofing debt that will allow Reinke Brothers to operate going forward without the need for further reorganization under Chapter 11, the document says. Under the terms of the agreement, Reinke Brothers will be able to resolve the debts with the other existing creditors. A judge granted the request to dismiss the bankruptcy case on January 2nd. Reinke, who owns the business with his brother, said the situation is all cleared up. He did not provide more detail on the agreement with the roofing company because he signed a non-disclosure agreement, he said. He said all of the creditors involved in the case have been paid per the agreement. "We're great. It's great," he said. "It's business. We've been in business for a long time. You don't get emotional about it. If you do, you'll fail." Statewide Roofing has not responded to requests for comment. Thank you for joining us for the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.